Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks so much for joining us this Sunday morning. Today we've got Dayton Youth Radio commentary from Bob Brekka and the first in our series on living with disabilities in the Miami Valley. Up first, July marks nearly three decades since President George H.W. Bush signed the Americans with Disabilities Act into law. The ADA was the nation's first comprehensive civil rights legislation designed to protect people with cognitive and physical disabilities. All this month, WISO is bringing you stories of Ohioans living with disabilities. It's a series we're calling Just Ask, talking about disability. The series grew out of a training WISO conducted this spring with four Miami Valley disability advocacy groups. For 6 weeks, WISO's April Leslie and producer Anna Lurie collaborated with people with disabilities to create the radio stories. And we kick off that series with a look at how the Americans with Disabilities Act has and has not improved conditions for many people with physical disabilities in Dayton. WISO's Jess Mador has the story.
At the outdoor signing ceremony, President George H.W. Bush told the crowd the Americans with Disabilities Act would guarantee independence, freedom of choice, and new opportunities for people with disabilities.
And now I sign legislation which takes a sledgehammer to another wall, one which has, for too many generations, separated Americans with disabilities from the freedom they could glimpse but not grasp. And once again, we rejoice as this barrier falls, proclaiming together, we will not accept, we will not excuse, we will not tolerate discrimination in America.
The Americans with Disabilities Act took effect in 1990. The landmark law built upon previous legislation banning discrimination in programs that receive federal funding. And over time, the law transformed America's built environment in key ways. Today, design elements such as wheelchair ramps, accessible bathrooms, and parking spaces are ubiquitous. Longtime Ohio disability rights advocate Susan Willis recalls how different things were before the ADA. When the law took effect, she walked with crutches.
I remember attending Ohio State University when there was no ADA, and traversing that campus for me was terribly difficult. There were steps at every building and all of this.
Now, Willis uses a motorized wheelchair. She says despite significant progress in improving accessibility for people with physical disabilities, violations of the ADA are pervasive.
The cities, the communities, they have to decide that this is important and we're going to do it.
Under the ADA, people can bring lawsuits or file complaints with eight federal agencies, including the Department of Justice and the Department of Transportation. But there's a growing backlog, and change is slow.
Because the ADA is a civil rights law, you don't see cruisers around that have civil rights police written on it.
Greg Kramer is assistant director of the Dayton Access Center for Independent Living. He says the burden of ADA enforcement falls largely on the public.
If they're in violation of a federal law and they don't do anything, what is your recourse to get them to change? And the only recourse is to file a complaint.
And meanwhile, he says spotty enforcement on the local level offers little incentive for people to obey ADA rules. Take parking, for example. Kramer uses a wheelchair and drives a full-size accessible van. He says people without disabilities often park in accessible spaces thinking they won't get caught.
There's been times I've had to drive around the parking lot a couple times and wait till somebody leaves.
Outside the Access Center, cars and trucks speed through this mostly industrial area near Interstate 75. Incomplete sidewalks force people with wheelchairs or walkers out into traffic or onto the grass. And the Access Center's Art Schlesinger, who uses a motorized wheelchair, says grass is no substitute for sidewalks. He points to a nearby grassy patch where a sidewalk abruptly ends. The grass is long. The ground is uneven.
This wheelchair is powerful enough that I could probably roll through the grass. But God forbid that it's muddy and I get stuck in the mud. And I've had that happen to me.
He says more education is needed to help lawmakers, home, and business owners understand the importance of sidewalks. Kramer says sidewalk maintenance is also critical to people with physical disabilities.
When you have sidewalks and there's a tree next to the sidewalk, that root might raise that sidewalk up an inch. For somebody who uses a wheelchair, that inch is a wall to us. There's no way to get over it.
Research shows the older you get, the more likely you are to have a disability. And as the population ages, Kramer hopes more Americans will become sensitized to accessibility issues. Ultimately, making more public and private spaces disability-friendly will also make getting around easier for everyone, young and old. For WYSO, I'm Jess Mador.
Stay tuned for more stories from Just Ask, talking about disability. Also, what questions do you have about the ADA? Tell us by going to WYSO.org. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WYSO Weekend. This week on Dayton Youth Radio, we have a story from Stivers School for the Arts graduate Jacqueline Adkins about her life as a student athlete with an eating disorder.
The story I want to share with you today isn't one that I'm proud of or even comfortable telling my friends and family about, but I think that it's one that a lot of people may need to hear. I'm a perfectionist. When people tell me that things don't have to be perfect, I kind of laugh to myself. Of course they do. I'd been doing long-distance running ever since junior high. My races weren't going as well as I wanted them in my freshman year of track. I saw other high school girls, and they were much faster and fitter than I was. I began exercising and dieting and counting calories. I used to drink whole milk because it tasted creamier and eat bread and pizza. After a few weeks of improved dieting, I became hooked. My coach and teammates were impressed with me, I could tell. I was so motivated that breakfast became unnecessary. I told my mom I wasn't hungry and asked that she pack me a nice salad in my lunch. I smiled at the compliments I was getting and noted the decline in a waistline I didn't even know I had until then. Good job, I would think to myself. I told myself that all this was worth it because of the pride and self-worth that I would feel when I made it to the end of the day without eating hardly anything. Of course, it would start all over again the next day, and I would be miserable once again, like a hamster on a wheel. By the time fall came, I wasn't really myself anymore. Some days, dinner came, and all I wanted to do was eat my fill, but I knew that I could not eat that cheese or that chicken because it was fattening and would destroy all my hard work. So I found grapes instead, or a bag of almonds that I let myself eat. But when I held one up to my lips, that one became another and another, and before I knew it, I had inhaled them all. I knew I had to take it back somehow, along with the calories I had consumed. So I went to the bathroom and forced myself to throw up. My mother found out about the purging one day. She looked at me with a look that made me not want to look at her back and told me she was getting me in to see a counselor. The school told her she needed a doctor's note, so she took me to my childhood pediatrician, who I also couldn't look in the eye. At the end of that day, I was admitted into the hospital for low heart rate, where they gave me the news that I had depression, anxiety, anorexia, and bulimia. As I sat in that hospital room, the one day estimated became two, then three, then a week, and then another. I can't really tell you all that went through my mind, except that I felt so stupid and phony, being bedridden when I had just run a 5K a couple of days ago, and I cried whenever one of my parents would leave. The wheelchair they made me ride in was the worst part. That and the knowledge that my family members would hear of this, my teammates would hear, my younger brother and sister might hear. I was ashamed of it. I've had relapses and breakdowns and numerous nightmares about consuming junk food. But with time and support, I've learned to silence that voice with an even stronger one. I'm one of the lucky ones, with incredible loving parents who got me the help I needed. We all want to be loved and accepted and praised, but the pain and struggle you get from unhealthy methods like starvation just aren't worth the pounds that you lose. They aren't. For Dayton Youth Radio at Stivers School for the Arts, this is Jacqueline Adkins.
That was Long Distance, written and produced by Jacqueline Adkins, graduate of Stivers School of the Arts. Special thanks to Eva Max Studis and Leslie Rogers. For Dayton Youth Radio, this is Basine Blunt.
To hear more Dayton Youth Radio stories, visit our website, wyso.org, or subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Support for Dayton Youth Radio comes from the Virginia W. Kettering Foundation and the Armott Boyer Charitable Trust, Fifth Third Bank trustee. Police canine units around the country have had to switch gears when it comes to using drug-sniffing dogs. That's because powerful synthetic opioids like fentanyl and carfentanil have proven harmful to both officers and police dogs alike. Sergeant Randy Bean heads the canine unit for the Dayton Police Department. He says the department does take steps to keep both officers and their canine assistants safe.
None of our dogs have been exposed to fentanyl where they've overdosed or had to be cared for with Narcan or by a vet.
How many dogs do you use there on the police force?
We currently have 5 canines assigned to the canine unit.
So how do you keep them protected?
First of all, the canines would avoid any situation where we think they might be exposed to fentanyl. If it was a suspicious package where we thought that might contain drugs, specifically fentanyl, the canine officers actually wouldn't do a sniff on a package like that. It hasn't been an issue, but if we would get a package, say, from the post office and they said, hey, we believe there's fentanyl in it, the officers actually wouldn't do a sniff on it because it's not worth the risk to the dogs having them overdose and, you know, potentially dying from it. It's just not worth the risk.
You do, however, carry a special brand of Narcan, is my understanding, from a veterinary?
Yes, all the canine officers have Narcan assigned to them that is given to them by a vet that they can actually inject into the dog rather than the nasal spray that officers carry that we give to humans. It's meant to be injected into dogs, and it's specifically meant for them.
Putting the dogs aside for a second, so there have been a couple of cases where officers themselves have come into contact with fentanyl or carfentanil. Can you speak to any new policies that have come into place since that revelation?
Officers actually have stopped field testing drugs just due to the risk of exposure because we've had several cases where officers believe that it could be possibly be cocaine or crack and it's turned out to be fentanyl. So just to be safe, we stopped doing all field tests on drugs and just send it to the crime lab. Officers, when they do recover drugs, they wear gloves for all recoveries just so they aren't exposed to fentanyl.
Sergeant, thanks for your time. Much appreciated.
You're welcome. Have a good day.
Sergeant Randy Bean heads the canine unit for the Dayton Police Department. Last September, 3 dogs in Florida searching for drugs overdosed after inhaling trace amounts of fentanyl. They were revived with the use of Narcan. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WISO Weekend. Thanks for joining us this morning. Area college graduates are preparing to begin their careers or the next part of their education. WISO commentator Bob Brekka is a professor at the University of Dayton and has been thinking about how his students look at sustainability issues inside the classroom and as citizens.
My training as a scientist was always in the lab, and when I teach classes, I'm very careful to stick to the facts. I keep my opinions mostly to myself. Or at least, I make it very clear when what I say is an opinion that's open for discussion. And I certainly don't try to indoctrinate students into my way of thinking. But neither I nor many of my students feel that it's enough these days to just stick to the classroom. Teaching classes and doing research on sustainability, renewable energy, and climate change means that I'm often faced with questions from my students about what they can do to help move things forward faster. And these students are increasingly aware that their academic work can be combined with their responsibilities as citizens. Let me give a couple of examples from the recent past. I've had several students who get their undergraduate degree in science or engineering, but have a more general sustainability focus as well. They then decide to go to graduate school to get a degree that includes both science and policy. These students want to understand what motivates us to actually make changes and how institutions are important in this process. Another recent student wanted to complement his graduate studies in renewable energy with a project to understand how statewide energy policies are decided and found out how messy that process can be. He also learned that our legislators could have used some better, more impartial information than what they were given before making their decisions. A final example is one that makes me very proud of our students. Last fall, the state legislature was debating whether to get rid of renewable energy standards. I learned that there would be hearings in a Senate committee on the issue and sent out a simple request to see if any students might be interested in going to Columbus to testify. I left it at that, but within 24 hours, six students found out how to submit testimony and did so. They then organized themselves to make the trip to the Capitol and waited patiently for hours to be able to give their two-minute testimony in support of renewable energy. I later heard from the students how excited they were to participate constructively in the political process in this way. They felt good about their efforts, even though the committee chair was visibly irritated that there was so much opposition to his bill. I also heard from many others at the hearing that they were impressed by how well-spoken the students were. Maybe even more importantly, these other, mostly older, participants were energized by seeing a new generation starting to be heard and speaking to the clean energy future they want for themselves. Sustainability issues are not only about technology. My students get it, and they want to find ways to combine technical subjects with real-world action for society. In the end, it's these students and their passion that make me hopeful for the future. For WISO, this is Bob Brekka.
Bob Brekka is a professor of physics and renewable and clean energy at the University of Dayton. He is research director of UD's Hanley Sustainability Institute and tweets at Bob Brekka. For more stories and commentaries, visit our website, wyso.org. This week on Culture Couch, we meet local sculptor John Barlow Hudson, who's finishing a piece of public art for the downtown Dayton Public Library building. Creating a public sculpture puts an artist in the middle of a conversation. The work is accessible. People can walk around it and touch it. Hudson's new work includes two seats. It's actually a place to sit and talk. Community Voices producer Lauren Schaus visited the artist's studio to learn more about his work.
John Barlow Hudson is standing in the sun at his workshop in Yellow Springs. He's in front of a granite monolith, sorting through a collection of blades and discs in a wheelbarrow.
Here's an example of the diamond pads, special
there's
kind.
Diamonds in this?
In the little blue plastic bits.
Wow.
Yeah.
These are the tools of his trade. Rather than the traditional hammer and chisel, John brings a little more power into his process.
All of this has been done with a 14-inch chop saw, and I've suspended it on my engine hoist, so I don't have to do all the work of holding it. And so you can remove a lot of material very quickly.
Folks in the Dayton area have almost certainly seen John's sculptures, whether they know it or not. The bronze Tree of Knowledge by the Yellow Springs Library, the tall, reflective double helix at Sinclair Community College, or the long, undulating yellow steel sculpture in downtown Dayton, to name a very few. He began his career working in stainless steel, but as he guides me around his workspace, he reveals his true love.
Each stone, like you see the pattern in this slab here, it's totally unique. Texture and shape and character and color pattern and unique like a person, whereas stainless steel, one sheet looks like the other.
John shows me what he's working on now, a piece in honor of public servants, which will be installed at the newly remodeled Dayton Metro Library. The granite sculpture will bear quotes about public service and will be composed of two seats on opposing sides of a wall.
So I'll make this one, this seat is going to be curved and sort of like the inside of an egg, so you can sit inside and feel enfolded. The other side is more geometric. The two seats interconnect, which creates an open space between the seats so that the two people facing different directions can still communicate, even hold hands, pass messages. It's about communication and breaking through walls.
We go inside John's gallery space. He introduces me to more of his work, talking about each piece with affection.
It rotates around its center. Mm-hmm. It's kind of infinite. It just keeps turning and turning and spinning. And in a way, this could symbolize a person. And the person's life turns around their center. It's always rotating every day.
And do you find that learning about, you mm-hmm. know, the spiritual, mm-hmm. does that motivate you at all?
That's kind of, to me, the main inspiration. Although an art gallery dealer always said, don't talk about that when you're trying to sell your work. But to me, that's the only thing that's really worthwhile.
He shows me a few photos of pieces in Cincinnati that were destroyed by their owners when the buildings housing them were renovated.
Did they let you know before they're going to do something?
No.
Like that?
Actually, my wife and her friend went to see the one, and it was gone. It's mind-blowing how someone can destroy something like that.
John's work dots the landscape of the Miami Valley, but his sculpture also spans the globe, with work on display in nearly 24 countries. He's like his sculptures in that way, well-traveled, and from an early age.
As a kid, I grew up, we traveled around the world. My dad was a geologist, and went to all these places like Machu Picchu and Jerash and so on. Climbing around on them, they were just mystical, and I guess I became inspired to make things like that that would last a long time, that would speak down through time to people in the future, like they were speaking to me. I hope that my work lasts a long time. That's why I like working with granite. My wife's in theater, and she's happy to do things that are transient like that. For me, if I'm going to do all this hard work, I want it to last a long time.
Sculptor John Barlow Hudson. His new piece is on track to be finished by the end of the summer, when the new Dayton Metro Library will open. For WYSO's Culture Couch, I'm Lauren Schaus.
Culture Couch is made possible by a generous grant from the Ohio Arts Council. Why So Curious is our occasional series where you ask questions and our reporters answer them online and on the air. Listener Aaron Hill wanted to know more about how local communities get the fireworks for their 4th of July celebrations. Why So Curious producer Liam Niemeyer takes us behind the scenes of Dayton's Lights in Flight fireworks show, which took off last week.
I wanted to get an idea of how long people think it takes to set up Dayton's fireworks show. So, last Thursday, I went to Riverscape Metro Park in downtown Dayton and asked around.
8 or 9 hours.
About a half an hour.
A day?
At least a day.
All day, until the stuff starts.
What do you guys think of the fact that over in Deeds Park right now, the Rozzi Fireworks Company, this morning just started setting up the fireworks display and are going to do 10, 12-hour days, 4 or 5 days in a row to set up the fireworks display?
That's next week. Dayton. That's crazy.
Planning for Dayton's fireworks show actually starts months before the 4th of July.
Because we're a city organization, we have to go through a bid process. What we do is come up with specifications or what we're looking for in a show, and then we get bids back that tell us what different fireworks companies will provide for us.
That was Lamont Hall Jr., Recreation and Youth Services Program Coordinator for the City of Dayton. Multiple city departments are involved in deciding what streets to close downtown, where to put fencing around Deeds Park, and more. Hall's job is to receive the bids from fireworks companies who want to put on the Dayton Independence Day show, like Rozzi Famous Fireworks.
Anytime you bid, it's always stressful because you don't know if you're going to get it or not. Naturally, you want it, definitely, because it's in your own backyard, and you hate to see some company come in from out of state and, you know, get the show.
That's Tom Fagan, sales director for the Cincinnati-based company. Rozzi did Dayton's fireworks show for the past 3 years. But their contract with the city expired in 2016, meaning they had to compete with 4 other fireworks companies to return to Dayton this year.
Well, let's put it this way. We do a lot of praying. And that's no joke.
City officials like Hall consider bids based on cost and show design. And this year, Rozzi was chosen again. Dayton will pay more than $50,000 for this year's fireworks display, made up of taxpayer money and sponsorship dollars from local businesses. That's good news for Tom Fagan, but it only gets busier from there. Dayton's show is one of dozens Rozzi is setting up for around the 4th of July holiday.
We're in Kentucky, we're in Indiana, we're in Ohio, as around our home tri-state area. There's quite a few other amusement parks that we're getting ready, you know, to do their fireworks for.
Last week, Rozzi loaded up their equipment and fireworks and brought them from their warehouse in Wilmington to downtown Dayton. When I arrived in Deeds Park on Thursday morning, the fireworks crew was in full swing getting set up.
This is my vacation. So. Fireworks vacation.
Dave Wallen has set up fireworks with Rozzi for 3 years. But for him and others on the crew, this is only a part-time job. Wallen is taking vacation time from a job at a glass company in Beaver Creek to work with Rozzi. And he kind of smells like gunpowder.
Do you get used to, like, the gunpowder smell? Like, I was just, like, walking up. Like, sure, I go home at night, my dog, first thing she does is walks up to me and starts, man, you smell like that again. So, yeah.
Wallen and 8 other workers are building what they call guns in an abandoned parking lot. These guns are orange and black fiberglass tubes that stand 3 to 6 feet tall. They're using nail guns to build wooden racks around the tubes. On the night of the show, these guns shoot the fireworks. George Parker III describes what it's like.
It basically, when you're down here at Ground Zero during the show, it's basically raining fire. It's pretty chaotic. It's controlled chaos, as I like to call it.
Safety is key throughout all of this. City of Dayton fire inspectors check inside every gun for flammable debris or damage. The Rossi Fireworks crew spends 4 days building, wiring, and loading hundreds of guns in the hot sun. They don't get paid much. It takes a lot of passion to work with fireworks. But Chrissy, the only woman on the crew, says the reward often comes right after the show.
Oh, cheers and clapping and laughing. And then, like, not that we ever get out there, we ever really get to see the crowd, but when you see videos of, like, little kids looking up and their faces light up when they see that, that's why I do it.
For WYSO, I'm Liam Niemeyer.
Why So Curious is sponsored by Proto Build Bar, proud supporter of Curious Minds. Let us know what you're curious about by visiting our website, wyso.org.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac for the third week of middle summer, the final week of the sweet corn moon, and the week that sycamore trees shed their bark, marking the center of the year. I've been making notes about the seasons in a daybook since 1978. Each day's post contains observations of common events in nature in my neighborhood, village, and nearby parks. I've learned that events in nature occur more or less at the same time each year. Sometimes I see trends, and I enjoy comparing the quality of seasons, and I enjoy finding new things the more I look. What is most rewarding in all of this is discovering my life in the observations I make. The daybook has become an autobiography in the sense Rousseau expressed in his Reveries of a Solitary Walker. When Rousseau went back through his botanical collections, he relived his life within what he felt was the idyllic context of his informal research. His collection of plants became a filter for his view of the past that only allowed the tranquility of his nature walks and his thoughts and daydreams of the time to shine through. As I look through the notes that I've made, I remember the tranquility that surrounded my own experiences of discovery and recording. I hold on to what Rousseau called accessory ideas that my entries evoke. And I see that the practice of noticing the world and of finding myself in it and of making myself part of its story has been so much of my life. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the fourth week of middle summer. In the meantime, go to the woods and make that part of your story.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at wyso.org.
That's it for this edition of WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world. I'm Jerry Kenny. We'll be back next Sunday morning at 10. Coming up next on WYSO, it's Vic McCunis with the Book Nook.